This is a Doxcast, not an Argon Soxcast, or a Bendis and Loxcast. Now I'm hungry. This is a Doxcast. It's a nerdy Toxcast. Discuss a Moxcast with Rich Early and friends.
Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to another silhouetted episode of the Doxcast. I am your co-host, Josh Trumbo, and with me, as always, is the redneck himself, Mr. Richard John Early. Rich, how are you doing today?
I'm just a redneck fan. I'm not actually a redneck, so excellent setup.
Thanks for tearing it down right away.
No,
appreciate that.
No, I was building it up, I swear. yeah, Josh, so we've got a really special podcast today. We've got an actual working comics professional on our podcast.
You mean we have a good guest host? No offense to our other guest hosts.
So just real quick around the room, Josh Trumbo, Brad Meixner.
That's me.
Darren Gregson.
Hello.
And me. And we are here with Donnie Cates. Hi, Donnie. How are you?
Hey. How you doing? I wanted to very quickly take issue with someone other than me being called a redneck.
Oh. Sorry.
How dare you?
It was between that and calling him the God of Blades, but that was giving him way too much credit.
Yeah, that's way too much.
So, anyway, real quick, we record the Doxcast live on Twitch once a month, and we post them every Monday morning. So follow us on iTunes, find the Doxcast, follow us at our website, www.paradoxcnc.com, and we'll give Donnie plenty of opportunity to tell you where to find him as well. So, all right, here's my first question, sir.
Okay.
This is something I try to ask everybody because I love to get to the background. What was your – when did you fall in love with comics, and what was your first comic you read?
Ooh, okay, so I started when I was a little bitty baby boy. My dad actually taught me how to read on comics. My brother, who's older than me by 2 years, was really into sports cards, baseball cards, and we would always go to this like specialty kind of hobby store. It wasn't like full-blown comic book store. It was more like sports stuff. And I would always get dragged to, but they had a comic book rack, and I was a little kid and I couldn't read or anything, but I was enthralled by all the comics on the rack. And my dad told me that he would buy one of these comic books for me if I would agree to learn how to read it. And so my dad taught me how to read on an issue of Green Lantern, and For the life of me, I wish I could find it, and I don't know what it is. Like I've looked through every single like cover to see if it would like trigger anything, and I can't seem to find it. But so it started off with like the Lanterns and DC actually, Batman, stuff like that. But then I quickly I met my first love. His name is Peter Parker. And he's my best friend. He's always there. As soon as I found Spider-Man, I was a Marvel maniac because Spider-Man quickly led me into Venom. And Venom was what really started all of this. I just became obsessed with Venom as a kid. I did all these sculptures. I would paint him and draw him all the time. And it just kind of spiraled out of control from there. I've never taken any time off. You know, a lot of people have these stories about, oh, once I got into high school, once I got into college, I took some years off and then I refound it and everything. I never did. Part of it was because, I don't know, like my last year of like, what was it? Like maybe like the summer in between middle school and high school, I shattered my right leg in like three places and was like couldn't walk for a year, and that was a great year because it was just nonstop comics. I mean, I couldn't walk or whatever, but like I was nonstop comics. I got to skip out of PE. It was awesome. And I've just kind of been off to the races ever since then. Now, is this just an origin story of me me getting into comics as a fan, or do you want me to
keep going
into the pro stuff?
Two quick thoughts. Since you were in high school and discovered Venom, does that mean you couldn't read until you were in your teens? Is that a typical redneck thing?
Okay, how dare you? Yeah. Strike one. No, I'm talking about when I was three, man. I was into. So I'm 33 right now. So you know, when I was, you know, 3 years old, it was 30 years ago, which would have coincided with the first appearance of, I think, Venom turned 30 in May. I would have been around the exact age of when Venom came into prominence. And it was a perfect time for me. And, you know, I'm a proponent of the 90s comics, really am. You know, like, I'm one of the guys who just, I still love the Clone Saga. I still love all the old Venom comics. I still love, you know, 90s Spider-Man, 90s X-Men, you know, Cable, Bishop, and Archangel, and all that kind of stuff. Joe Mad comics, stuff like that. I was into it as a little kid and never stopped.
Yeah,
and then, I'll say the high school thing, the year that I spent with my leg kind of shattered, that was a big deal because that was kind of around the time where my interests started to kind of splinter off. That's when I found stuff like Preacher and Watchmen and Sandman and, you know, Alan Moore Swamp Thing. That's when I found the Vertigo and the British guys, you know, and that's when it became less of a, oh, this is just a thing I do. Like, cause it was always just there was always comics around, and I would always just get them, and I was entertained by them. But then, you know, around that time, I started reading them, and I was like, man, there's something else going on here. Like, this is next level stuff. Like, it was one comic after, you know, the next where I read it, and I would say things like, man, you can do that in a comic book? Like, like that counts? Like, that's like, this art form can do this as well? And then probably the one that kind of blew my mind the most was Powers. I remember getting Bendis's Powers, and it just blew my mind. It just blew my mind. You know, long stretches of just conversation, right? Like a book that was confident enough in its storytelling to just sit in a room and talk, you know? And that really blew my hair back, you know. And, you know, I know that me and Matthew Rosenberg, who we both kind of started at Marvel around the same time, we both credit Powers pretty much solely with the reason why we're doing what we are now.
Well, yeah, the reason I always start with that is in my experience over the years, you know, I've run a shop for 25 years, and when I got into comics, I was 5 years old. And for me, it was very closely tied to my health issues, my disability, and things like that, and I always gravitated back to them. And then as an adult, I dropped out of college and opened a comic shop, you know, seemed wise. But, you know, the point is, like, for me, there's this tie between this falling in love with comics and the professionalism or the profession of comics. And so, yeah, you know, take us, how did you then turn that into a career? How did that happen?
Well, Richard, you'll never believe this. I dropped out of college and opened up a comic book store.
Boom! Solidarity, bro.
I really, really did, man. I went to college right out of high school. This is like 2004. I hated it. I didn't have any business being there. I didn't know what I wanted to do, right? The wheel hadn't clicked yet in my brain of, hey, you like this thing so much, like, do this thing, right? Like, that hadn't clicked. It was still like a, oh, that's just a hobby thing that I do. I enjoy that, you know? And so I went to school for acting, because, you know, whatever. And I went for 2 years at the, what the hell is the name of my college? Stephen F. Austin University, which is in Nacogdoches, Texas, neck of nowhere. And it was there that I failed for 2 years. I failed horribly for 2 years because I just couldn't be bothered to go to class. But I met a girl there, and I fell in love with that girl. And she moved to Austin, and I followed her to Austin. And she is currently inside of my house right now because I married that girl. And so that paid off. And so around that time, when I first moved up to Austin, I was a cook for a very long time. I say a very long time, maybe 2 years. And then I got hired to just be like a clerk at a comic book store. But then a bunch of things in like rapid succession happened where a couple of the managers quit or got fired. And it was a chain of comic book stores. We had, when I started, we had five. No. When I started, we had four. And I was suddenly, like, within a month, given my own store to manage. And then from there, I ended up managing all the stores with a primary focus on the one that I ran. Hold on, really quick. The question is, how did I become a... start making comics, is that right?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's awesome.
It's a roundabout way. Well, this is all pertinent because I ran those comic book stores, and I honestly could have done that for the rest of my life. I loved it. I loved being a retailer. We had a really cool like series of shops, and we had a really cool vibe. It was very down-home, real friendly barbershop. Like, I knew all my customers. I knew what they wanted. We had the ability to, especially at my location, for me to just put books into customers' pulls because I just knew that they would like it. I just be like, well, you're going to dig this, of course, because I know you, and I knew everyone's families and everything. It was phenomenal. I had such a good time. And then I ran those stores into the ground. through, I would argue, no fault of my own, but maybe a little bit of fault of my own. And so when I lost those stores, I was kind of devastated. I found myself kind of unhirable because I didn't have anything that you would call skills in, like, the regular world. but I knew that I really, really wanted to stay in comics somehow. And I was and still am a decent artist. I've drawn my whole life and everything, and so I, when the comic book stores closed down around late 2008, I told myself that I was going to give this thing a go to start trying to make my own comics. And so to that end, I applied and got accepted to go to SCAD, the Savannah College of Art and Design, where I majored in sequential art, which is, you know, comics. And I went to try and be a penciler. But then I was out there and I was in classes with Jeff Shaw, who draws my Thanos run and God Country. And I was in classes with Trad Moore, who's phenomenal. And so being in classes with those guys, and they were that good back then, you know. And so I was like, well, I'm never going to be as good as those guys. I could work for 30 years and not be as good as those guys are right now in their freshman year. And so, that combined with, we had to take like a mandatory writing class. And the professor of that class, so I had never written before in my life before 2009. I'd never written anything. And the professor in that class saw something in me and kind of took me aside and said, hey, you have a knack for this. Like, it's, you know, it's not sharpened or anything, but, you know, if you worked at it, like, you really have something. And he was very encouraging. And so that combined with the fact that I was never going to be as good as Trad Moore or Jeff Shaw, I kind of formed a new strategy in my head where I was like, well, I'll just learn how to be a better writer and I'll hire Jeff Shaw. And so I went to SCAD for 2 years straight. I went through summers and everything. I ended up doing the hosting the Sequential Art podcast, which is called Sequel Lab, which to my horror, I'm sure you can find old episodes of out there. I was so annoying. And then I took one summer off, and in that summer I applied for and I got an internship at Marvel. And so I went out to Marvel and I was an editorial intern, and that was phenomenal and incredibly stressful. And that was really where everything started to happen. Not because this was 2010, right? And as you'll notice, I didn't get hired at Marvel as a writer until 2017. So it's not like they were giving out jobs to their buddies or anything. But it was writing boot camp. It really was. I mean, every day of my life, I was writing all the recaps, all the, you know, the previously on X-Men stuff. I wrote that. That's me. there's actually books out there right now that, like, sometimes, every once in a blue moon, a fan will figure out a timeline and bring a book from Marvel that I wrote the recap to a signing of mine. I did artwork for a recap. It was Ant-Man the Wasp by Tim Seeley. And the recap page, the gag of the recap page was supposed to be that Eric O'Grady, the irredeemable Ant-Man, was doodling in Hank Pym's notebook. And that doodling told the story of the recap, right? And so Jordan White, who I was his intern, he's now my editor on Thanos. That's crazy. Jordan was like, hey, will you do this? And so I did it. And because I did artwork for it, meaning stick figures, they had to credit me. So it is the biggest joy of my life to be able to go back to SCAD and go to all these, like, fancy artists and stuff and say, yeah, I just got my first Marvel credit for drawing. I don't know what the big deal is, you guys. It's fucking easy.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Do some stick figures. Yeah. So, yeah, my first ever published credit as a creator is drawing for Marvel, which is hilarious. So I did that, and while I was there, that's where the work ethic came from. That's where the, you know, learning what a monthly schedule looks like, learning how all the pieces move, all that kind of stuff, that's where that came from. And so while I was there, I started to make my own comics off the clock, and when my internship ended, I through SCAD and through being a retailer, and then through being a Marvel intern, what I kind of had on my side was the idea that I knew a lot of people. Now, I didn't have any product to pitch or anything, and no one knew me as a creator or anything, but I pretty much knew every editor from DC, from Vertigo, from Image, from Boom. I kind of knew them by face, like what they look like and stuff, right? Which is, I know it seems like a small thing, but it's something that I tell young creators all the time, like study these people, find out what they look like, because when you go to a con, they're all there and they're just people, right? They're all just walking around. And so to make an incredibly long story short, I ended up making my own like little mini comics, my own little ash cans, and I went to cons. I just started flying myself out to cons and handing my books off. And the second con I went to, I was able to get one of my ash cans in front of someone at Dark Horse, and they liked it, and they gave that ash can to the president, Mike, and Mike called me and published it in Dark Horse Presents. I think, what was it, issue 24 or something like that? And then from there came Buzzkill with Jeff Shaw, and then Ghost Fleet, and then Paybacks, and then everything else.
Whew!
Yeah,
that was awesome. Brad wrote a bunch of these questions coming up, and so I want him to pick one or throw them out there that he likes. So.
Okay, as you're now writing for, you know, you started with Dark Horse, you've moved to Image, you know, you got one book coming up from Aftershock, and you got your Marvel stuff. What is your editorial? What differences do you feel like? You own some of your properties, so is there much editorial compared to, you know, I mean. At this point, you are writing three of Marvel's cinematic characters. Loki is, you know, probably a fan favorite, the only villain to survive a movie. You know, Thanos has made it through. I have to assume you're not killing Thanos in Infinity War. So he's going to make it through. So you're writing these characters that are going to have, you know, legs for a long time, that are going to be, household names, and you're currently writing them. You're working on Strange as well. So is there drastic difference in your editorial oversight from, you know, the six issues of God Country you put out versus your current run on Thanos? Are there drastic differences, or do you feel that an editor handles each property in the similar way?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely differences, right? I mean, God Country, we didn't have an editor. I mean, that was, we had people who helped us proofread things like that. And I had people that I trusted to read the scripts, but really just for readability, you know. The thing with a creator-owned book is that you're God. And so no one can say, well, hey, you know, Emmett Quinlan wouldn't say that. And I'd be like, pretty sure it would. I invented him. So, yeah, he's going to say that.
Okay.
You know, but it always helps to have someone there. And I have a few people that I really count on that I trust to read my scripts and say, hey, this is garbage. Don't do this, you know. And so on God Country, that's really... On the image stuff, just in general, Redneck's a little bit different because it's through Skybound, so there is an entire editorial team. But at the end of the day, again, with them, they are, and I'm going to say this, and it's going to sound like I'm being a dick, but this is, I'm quoting them, okay? They are there to help me make sure that my idea is brought to fruition in the best possible way. They aren't there to put their thumbprints on my story and change it to what they want the story to be. They are there to make sure that what I want is coming through as clear as possible. So on Redneck, notes are very rare. Same thing with Baby Teeth. Baby Teeth, I mean... I'm 10 issues deep at this point. I think issue 7 or 8 just came out. I don't think I've ever gotten a note. I don't think I've ever received one note from Mike Marks. Mike Marks is a very, very, very hands-off kind of a guy. Not in a bad way at all. When I say hands-off, he lets your story be what you think your story needs to be. He's very hands-on with making sure that book comes out, you know, and handling everything and juggling everything. He's phenomenal. But yeah, that's been my experience with the creator-owned stuff. People tend to just get out of your way once they know you and trust you, right? You know, Marvel is different, obviously. These aren't characters that I own. You know, these aren't characters that these editors own. So we're all kind of in service to each other, you know? But it's not in any way, like, I know that, like, when I wasn't working at Marvel and when I was a retailer, when I didn't really know how, me personally, but when I didn't know how the machine worked at Marvel or DC, you know, you would hear these stories about editorial control and, you know, editorial mandates and things like that. And I gotta say, this has not at all been my experience. You know, knock on wood, so far so good. It's been phenomenal. That being said, yeah, of course, there's gonna be times when they're like, hey, you know, and by the way, this example I'm about to say is 100% fictional, so no one write an article about this, please. like, they can't, if they're, like, if I write, you know, Loki crushes this guy's head and gouges his eyes out, they're going to be like, whoa, relax. I can't be doing shit like that. But the thing is, I guess, at the end of the day, is that you kind of know the environment you're walking into, you know, like, I would never write that in the script. Because I've been reading Marvel Comics my entire life. I know where the lines are. I know what you can kind of get away with. That being said, I mean, anybody who reads my Thanos knows that I'm pushing those lines for sure. But, you know, I mean, Doctor Strange and Thanos and all the stuff I've done at Marvel, in a lot of ways, it's not that different from the creator-owned stuff. You know, when you're doing a creator-owned book, you're constantly searching for new angles, for new and inventive storylines, things that people won't see coming, new ways to convey familiar emotions, things like that. And at the end of the day, if the story is about a bunch of redneck vampires in Texas or about two, you know, gods of magic in Manhattan, at the end of the day, you're just writing about people. You know, you're just writing about the same set of emotions. You're still telling... The same rules of storytelling apply in both environments, right? So it's not that dissimilar. That being said, you know, in Redneck, I kind of do whatever I want. and Marvel, there is the risk of just being overruled. I'm just being like, hey, no, we're not going to do that. But that hasn't happened to me. Like, I think it is because I grew up reading these comics and I know them so well. I'm such a Marvel zombie that I kind of know what I can get away with to a certain degree, you know? So yeah, they definitely are, they're both the same, they're the same game, right? They just have different rules, but I don't find either of them to be altogether restrictive or negative at all. You know, when you're working at Marvel, you also have to take into account that there's, you know, 30, 40 other people writing books that you need to interact with and play nice with. So a lot of the times, the stuff you get back where it's like, hey, Loki can't smash that dude's head open with a crowbar, it's not because Loki can't do that. It's because, hey, that guy needs to be alive because Al Ewing is going to use him over in this thing, you know? It's, like, it's a lot of that kind of stuff, and so it's actually really fun in that way. I find it to be a blast. But yeah, I mean, they all have their different challenges and stuff. Honestly, sometimes in the creator-owned space, I'll turn in a script and I'll get back an email saying, hey, this is all great, we dig it, no notes. And in my head, I'm like, oh, come on. Just give me a note. I know it's not perfect. Don't do that. Don't you do that. I know there's something that can be improved, you know? So, yeah, it's all different, you know?
That reminds me of, I'll have a new employee, and I'll tell them, all you got to do is call me. Just call me over anything. And then they don't call me, and then I think, okay, like, I know something's wrong. Why aren't you calling me?
Yeah, exactly.
Brad, do you have a follow-up to that?
I guess it's in vain with the editorialship. Because you have your creator-owned stuff, like, you could be, we don't know, you don't have to reveal, but, I mean, you could be 3 years out on Baby Teeth, but you could never get that far ahead with Thanos or Doctor Strange, because, like you said, your editorial ship, you'd be like, we need this character in this spot at this point for another storyline. So, you could have the framework done, you don't have to reveal if you do or don't, but I'm just, how far in advance... are you 3 months ahead on a Marvel book, but you can be a year ahead on your personally owned stuff? Is that a possibility, or do you try and stay about the same distance on your books?
Yeah, it's certainly easier on a creator-owned book because no one else has to plan for you. You know, you can just go and do it. Like, you know, Redneck, Redneck number 9,
I think it's 9. This week, you're talking about this Wednesday.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think it's 9.
Yeah, like, issue 9 comes out right now. I'm writing issue 18 right now. Like, so I am crazy far ahead on that one. I always stay around 10 issues ahead on that thing, and I have Redneck planned out for the next 20 or 30 issues. Baby Teeth is the same way. And I'm doing another creator-owned book that hasn't been announced yet, and it won't be announced for another few months. But I'm deep into that, you know. With Marvel, and it's different for every book. It just depends on how insular your character is. You know, Thanos is a decently insular character, since just by nature of his story, he doesn't tend to interact or appear in other people's stories due to... I mean, when Thanos shows up, it's a big deal. You know, if you're reading Squirrel Girl and Thanos shows up, that's a big fucking deal, you know? And so, you know, those things tend to be few and far between, so it's not that, you know, it's not really anything I have to worry about. So I can kind of plan ahead longer on Thanos, right? Doctor Strange is a little bit different, you know? Because Doctor Strange is, you know, a main dude. And so, you know, he shows up a lot. That being said, there is kind of an unspoken rule where if you're on the title, if you're the captain of the Doctor Strange ship, you don't defer to other people's wants. They defer to what you're doing. Does that make sense?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and this is, again, a fictional example. let's say somebody wanted to use
Doctor Strange.
You
really want Loki to hit somebody with a crowbar, don't you?
No, like if somebody wanted to use Doctor Strange in a storyline because they need the Sorcerer Supreme to show up for something, well, they would go to their editor and they would say, hey, this is the kind of the pitch that I have for this issue. Like, they need the Sorcerer Supreme to show up. That editor would defer to my story and say, well, you can't have Strange because Strange is not the Sorcerer Supreme. It would be Loki. You know what I'm saying? So like they would bend to me, and I would do the same thing for them. You know, I would bend for them if they are the captain of that ship. You know, so you can kind of cement things if you're playing in your own sandbox. Now, what's interesting about my Strange run is just by the nature of the story, things get more complicated when you bring in guest stars from other people's books, right? Because the Marvel offices are divided by books. So you have like the Spider office and the Avengers office, and then like your street, like Daredevils, Luke Cages, you know, Moon Knight kind of guys, stuff like that, right? And so if you're doing Doctor Strange and you just stay in Doctor Strange lane, then you're only going through your office, which also happens to be the Spider-Man office. But if you are like, for instance, I want to do a Doctor Strange story that Loki is in, well, then you're now dealing with two offices because everything has to get vetted through the Thor office as well to make sure that I'm not changing anything that maybe Jason had plans on for Thor, or I'm not, you know, bumping into his stories or anything. So things do get a little bit more complicated when you bring someone else into it. But, you know, we have these retreats that we do, you know, 2 to 3 times a year. I'm actually leaving for one tomorrow, where we all get into a room and we hash things out. And so for the most part, it's not a surprise. You know, if I call Jason and I say, hey, so I'm going to do this thing with Loki here, and he's going to do X, Y, and Z. Jason will say, oh, that's right. That's a thing you were talking about in the retreat. Yeah, that's cool. That's fine. Yeah, I you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, and so it's all very collaborative and very cool, you know. Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
I just went off on a whole other thing.
No, that was really good. I have a follow-up from this is one of Darren's questions, but I know he's How do you divide your time? You know, what are your priorities? Do you have, you know, a deadline at Marvel that has to be met, so then Rednecks on the back burner, and how do you balance that against, you know, real life? Like what's your schedule like, and how do you balance those things?
Yeah, it depends on the month. Like this month, I'm not only writing Doctor Strange and Thanos and Baby Teeth and Redneck, I also am writing the Doctor Strange event that we're doing in February. It's called Damnation. And so it adds a lot to the schedule, you know, because not only does Damnation double ship, Doctor Strange, the tie-in, double ship as well. So my workload ballooned up this month. About mid-December, I've turned in a new script every 3 days.
Ooh, wow.
Which is bananas, yeah. Right? That is not normal. Like, it slows back down next month. It's really... So, Redneck, you know, I said I'm so far ahead.
Yeah.
And, you know, Redneck is probably my most personal book. I don't know. I love that book, and so I like to give it a lot of time. It's also, of all the books I write, probably the hardest book to write, because I really did myself a disservice by making the narrative captions belong to a 200-year-old quasi-poetic redneck vampire, which is a lot harder than you would think to pull off. And so I like to give Redneck a lot of time. Baby Teeth, probably the easiest book to write, because Sadie's narrative voice is probably the closest to my own voice, but she's very cavalier in how she speaks. You know, she's very easy to convey information to the audience because she just says, hey, look, I don't know what's going on here, but like crazy cult type people running around and blah, 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 you know? And so it's very easy. So generally speaking, I write every day. I try and write at least 10 pages every day. Not because I'm efficient, but because of the complete opposite, because I'm quite lazy. And so I force myself to work really hard so that I can still have days off and be lazy. And so, you know, when I have a script due every 3 days, what that looks like is 2 days of actually scripting really hard, and then I take a day off for my own sanity, and I just kind of kick it around the house, you know. Play drums a lot. When I'm on an intense writing day, I tend to do, like, you know, a few hours writing and then take an hour off and play drums. I pretty much work all day until my wife gets home from work, and then I stop and I cook the dinner for her, and then when she goes to bed, sometimes I'll go back to full scripting, but most of the time after she goes to bed, I will just I'll do notes, which means I just literally pull the note app off my phone and kind of freeform write, and that's just kind of outlining and getting all the kind of the raw ideas out. I do a lot of pre-writing, so it really helps my schedule a lot, since I am writing so many books. The worst thing that can happen to me is for me to have, like, you know, baby teeth issue 10 is coming up, and I pull up my word processor and I have no idea what happens. I'm just like, I don't know what happens in this issue, right? That's never happened because I don't have time. Excuse me. I don't have time to sit around and have writer's block.
Yeah.
I just don't, right? And so I tend to outline very heavily and get all of that done and kind of clear a road for myself, so that by the time I'm actually sitting down to put my fingers on a keyboard, I know every page. You know, and then from there, it's just a matter of breaking it down into panels and dialogue and captions and stuff like that. So it's manageable. And I'm adding 3 new books to the workload next month.
Yeah, I picked up on Twitter that you said you had a new Marvel series. I'm not going to ask any details, and maybe other things as well. And is it Relay from Aftershock? You're not writing that, but are you consulting on that? Is it Relay, the Aftershock book?
Yeah, Relay. I was supposed to write Relay.
Okay.
And then life things happened, meaning Marvel things and baby teeth things and redneck things. And it just got away from me, but I had written an outline, a pretty thorough outline. And I really loved the project. And I eventually just told Aftershock, who are amazing, and we're all really good friends, I said, you know what we should do is we should just find somebody who's dope to write this, and they can either keep my outline or throw it in the garbage, whatever. But, you know, Aftershock, for the longest time, especially in their first year and much of their second year, they were kind of a home for kind of A-list talent to kind of do whatever they wanted, right? They had, like, Garth Ennis and, like, Ellis and things like this, right? And it was my kind of perception of the company that, like, you know, when I was before I got Baby Teeth over there, I was like, well, you know, Aftershock just does, like, prestige comics by A-list dudes. It's not really a viable option for me, you know. And then it was all of a sudden, because they lowered their standards, let's be clear. And I didn't rise up.
No.
No, and so I was like, you know, this is a... Because the Baby Teeth did very well for them, and then, you know, Redneck and God Country and Thanos and everything. I was in a position where I could... Aftershock trusted me a lot, and I knew Zach Thompson, and I was a really big fan of his work, and he's a great dude. And I was in a position to come to Aftershock and say, hey, this dude should do this. Like, we should really champion new creators. We should really show, we should harbor talent. We should start building a talent pool here, because there's only so many Garth Ennis's that are going to come and play, and they're going to leave.
Yeah.
Right? Which is just the nature of things, yeah. You know? But if we can build a talent pool up, you know, and keep them and let them do whatever they want, you know, and really explore the depths of their creativity and stuff, that'll be really fun. And so Zach came on and read my outline, and he and I share very similar aesthetics and similar, tastes in sci-fi. And so it was a very natural fit. And he came on, and he is doing a phenomenal job. No one tell him that I said this, but probably a better job than I could have ever done. But don't tell him that.
Okay. We'll keep it secret. Yeah.
And the book is just gorgeous. But yeah, I mean, you know, it sounds, I don't know, lame when I say it, but yeah, I'm just kind of a producer on the book. Like I read over the scripts, and I, you know, approve art sometimes when I have time and things like this. But it is certainly Zach's book. He took the outline that I put there and improved it and made it his own. It is very much his own thing.
You're pretty safe with our normal number of listeners. So, Josh, you've been listening to all this. You got anything you'd like to ask?
I do. Well, first of all, I should be the good cop here, or the bad cop, depending on how you look at it, and say we have time for probably one or two more questions before we have to cut it off, which is unfortunate because I'm really enjoying this. One thing I just wanted to bring up is I've got the opportunity to read some of your books. Being the tech guy here, I'm not necessarily the comic book guy. I read what I can when I can, and Darren gave me a whole good list of things to read over the weekend, so I did my homework. And I noticed, in your books here, there's definitely a strong family element. That's a really strong part of the stories and the writing there, and I'm just kind of curious about that. Is that something that you intentionally try to put into your books? Is that something that really, is a big focus to you, especially in your creator-owned books?
If you look at the arc of my creator-owned book, starting with Buzzkill, and then all the way through to, I suppose, the most recent of them, which would have been Baby Teeth, the family element didn't really start creeping in until God Country. Mm-hmm. God Country, Redneck, Baby Teeth all have that familial bond to it. And before that, you know, Buzzkill was about addiction, and Ghost Fleet was about hatred, and Paybacks was about having a good time while making fun of, you know, Marvel and DC Comics. To be completely honest, where that comes from is about, you know, three and a half years ago, I had a pretty serious medical event happen to me, and it was rough. It was kind of touch and go there for a little bit. Obviously, I came out on the other side of it, okay. But you know, when you go through something that is kind of life and death, right? Mm-hmm. It really makes you reevaluate your values, and really makes you start thinking about what's important to you and what you care about. And to that end, I came out the other side of it with a lot I had to say, a lot of things that I wanted to talk about, which is, any writer will tell you what is what you want out of life. You want to have something to say, right? And so God Country was my first dive into that, you know, Emmett's struggles of having Alzheimer's and being very, very sick and not being able to provide for his family or be the man that he wants to be for his family came directly out of what happened to me. You know, God Country, if anybody's read it, is certainly about learning how to let go, right? And what you keep when someone lets go. And that was all very much tied into that. And since then, you know, I had done God Country, which was a little bit about my personal experience through the lens of loved ones and family and things like that. And then Redneck was very much about my actual roots of my family. You know, my extended family comes from Sulphur Springs, which is a real place. I didn't just invent it for Redneck. And tonight was very much talking about my dad's kind of family. And my dad had a really rough childhood. And very long story short, when my mom and my dad had my brother and I, they decided that they were going to kind of break a long cycle of violence and negativity and hatred and stuff with my brother and I, and raise us in a family full of love and of art and appreciation for learning and things like that, right? And so that's what Redneck is about. It's about a family that just because they have evil in their blood has decided that they're not going to be monsters anymore, right? And so it all kind of happened in succession, where I had found myself writing God Country, which is about me, and then Redneck, which is about my dad and my extended family. And then I was like, you know, I've been writing a lot of really rough and tumble masculine books, you know, and so I wanted to write something that was the complete opposite. I wanted to write something from my mom, and that's where we get baby teeth from. You know, around the same time as my medical issue, my brother had a baby, and his name is Dylan, and he's my best friend in the world. There's a reason that like the main character in Redneck is an uncle, because that's what I am now. Mm-hmm. And so at the same time as I was like dying, we had this new little bundle of joy. And so when I got out of the other side of it, I wanted to write about that little kid, and I wanted to write about motherhood and all these things that I witnessed. I witnessed my brother changing and becoming a different person, becoming a father. I witnessed his wife, my sister-in-law, turn into a mom, and like all these intense feelings that come along with having a child, you know. And I was witnessing these things from afar and kind of taking notes, and poured it all into baby teeth, you know. So it's really, to answer your question, all of that stuff came from me turning 30, almost dying, and then growing up.
There, I mean, when you pick books up, you can, and you get familiar with the writer, you can sort of hear that writer or feel that writer in the background of the book a little bit. And, you know, I was thinking about that with Doctor Strange, because there's this panel where Loki just has this giant shit-eating grin on his face in issue 381. And I was thinking about you, and I thought, is, you know, there's a way in which Loki is sort of like you, like where you get to be in this world playing with these toys that you're not supposed to have, and all of a sudden you have them. I don't know if that's accurate at all, but that was just a sense I had of you were enjoying
more accurate
that
than you even know. I try to inject a lot of myself into these Marvel characters and try and make them as personal as possible. With Doctor Strange, you know, there's a big running theme throughout my entire Doctor Strange run of this word exile. You know, the big spell that they're all after is called the Exile of Sing Soon, and Doctor Strange is at a place where he feels very alone. He feels very cast out. And that's kind of how I was feeling when I got the gig. I, for a lot of reasons, I felt very separate from the industry. I felt very outside of everything. You know, I was a creator-owned kid. You know, I came up doing indies and everything, and now I was doing this big Marvel book, and I found myself kind of a part of both worlds, but somehow not. Like, I wasn't big enough to hang with the big Marvel boys, and all of a sudden, it's probably more me projecting this onto myself than anybody actually treating me this way, but I felt like, oh, you're no longer a part of the indie world because you're doing this. And so I felt very alone, and so that's where that came from. And my cat died right as I started writing it, and she was always hanging out on my lap. So that's why he's a veterinarian. Because I really needed to talk about that in a certain way. And then Loki, you know, Loki is, you ask anyone who's ever written that character, he's the hardest character to write at Marvel. It's because every word out of his mouth has to be able to be read like six different ways. Is it a lie? Is it a truth? Is it a lie on top of a lie to conceal a truth? You know, like it's everything. And to that end, he can kind of seem pretty impenetrable as a relatable character. And it took me a little while to figure out who he was and how I could relate to him. And then it hit me. He's a little brother. He is the consummate little brother. And my older brother is this athletic blonde dude with blue eyes who gets straight A's and is an attorney and is like a model Eagle Scout citizen, just shining golden god. And then I am whatever this is. Right. And so I was like, I super relate to this dude. Like, you know, since Loki was born, his role was cast for him. From the day he was like brought in to Odin's family, imagine being a little kid and being told you're the god of lies. And it's like, what? why do I have to be? And then everyone's shocked that he became a bad guy. It's like, you guys, you told him he was the god of lies. Like, so it's like when you put kids in the Slytherin house and you're shocked they turn evil. Don't sort kids. Right. Don't sort kids. And so, you know, and there's this idea of Loki that I very much related to, where he's just like, you know, even every time I try and be a good dude, what comes back at me from all of you is a pointed finger calling me a liar. So you know what? If you guys want me to be a bad guy, well, let me show you how bad I could be, right? And he's just trying to get attention. He's just trying to gain some footing on this giant shadow that he lives under Thor. And my brother and I don't have an adversarial relationship by any stretch of the imagination, but certainly growing up, being a fat kid who had a stutter, who read comics before reading comic books was cool, and being under Andy's shit, my brother's name is Andy, being in his shadow was something I could very much relate to. So absolutely, there's that. Now, the craziest comparison on that kind of stuff is Thanos, because weirdly enough, he's the one I relate to, like, the most, which is disturbing, right? because what I pushed into Thanos, I was actually on Thanos before I was on Strange. I got the gig, even though Strange was announced first. I was on Thanos. I got the call at Emerald City last year, so like last March. And here's the thing. So when I started doing creator-owned comics and stuff, obviously being a big Marvel nerd, it was always my goal. I always really wanted to be an exclusive creator for Marvel, right? But in my head, in the back of my mind, even when my God Country was coming out and it was gaining some steam and people started to kind of pick up and know who I was a little bit more, even in the back of my head then, I was like, you know, I'm probably still about like 5 to 6 years out before I ever get to Marvel, before I'm ever an exclusive creator. You guys, it was January to March. It was like 3 months, right? And so what Thanos is about a man who has conquered everything and is looking out and being like, wait, is that it? Are we done? Like, did we get to the top of the mountain already? Like, oh, shit. How did that happen, right? And so it's a book about Thanos, like, kind of waking up someday and looking at having won. And, you know, the thing that I've realized in my career is that there is no top to the mountain. You set a goal and you get up there, and what you find at the top of that mountain is just more mountain. Right? And that's how it should be, you know? But certainly at the time, because I had turned in, like, you guys, I had turned in 2 Thanos scripts, 2, and they gave me my exclusive. And mind you, neither of those had come out yet. They were just scripts. They hadn't even been drawn. And so, and, like, you know, Redneck hadn't even come out, Babe Keith hadn't come out, I hadn't even gotten to Doctor Strange yet. Like, life was bananas. Nothing made any sense. I couldn't wrap my head around any of it. And so I just poured everything into Thanos, with Thanos, young Thanos, showing up to, like, King Thanos' realm and being like, what? How? How did you win? What are you talking about? This is ridiculous, you know? So, yeah, it's been a weird fucking year, you guys.
Well, as Josh said, you know, we've had you for about an hour, which is super generous of you, and so I think we should wrap up.
Can I just add, yep. I have a few questions. These are nice and simple. I think they're nice and simple, Donnie.
I'll try and make it short.
Well, one is from my wife, so I really need to ask this question. My wife, Amy, she read God Country yesterday. I bought her a copy, and she read it. And she wanted to know where you came up with the name of Valifax.
Oh, man. Everyone's so let down.
No, we won't be let down.
You guys, it's every god name. I thought I was going to, like, do, like, deep research and make them, like, be clever names that meant things. None of them are. I just made them up. Valifax is just the combination of the word valor and Shadowfax, the king of horses from Lord of the Rings. And then, like, a tomb, like the god of kings, is my cat's name was Autumn. So I just, like, dropped a letter out of it because she was sitting in my lap when I was trying to come up with a god's name. And I was like, that sounds tight. none of it is. But you know what, though? It ended up, and I was kind of, they were all literally placeholder names until I came up with something more. But then the more I wrote it, I was like, oh, you know what? This story is not about the god. It's not ever about the god. It's not about a magic sword. So I ended up putting more meaning into the people's names and just let the gods' names sound like weird Kirby names.
Yeah. my next question: do you know about the Image giant-sized artist-proof editions? You know those where
yeah.
Do you think there'll ever be a God Country version? Because I would really want one of those. You do.
I do think that, yes.
Oh, excellent. That makes me very happy. Okay. And my final question.
Now,
go ahead.
Whether Image thinks that or not is the real question. I think they will be.
I think they should. Yeah, I think they should. My final question is so related to art as well. Do you think you'd ever do a variant cover for... Because do you still draw? Do you think you'd ever do any interior art for your books or a variant cover or anything? I mean, you may not have time, but would that be something you consider? Or have you done it and I've missed it, you know?
I did a pinup in the back of maybe the second or third issue of Buzzkill where I drew a character named Dr. Black.
Okay.
It was not very good. And, you know, I did some pretty dope stick figures for Marvel once.
Yeah. I wrote down that. I made a note of that. Do you remember which issue that was?
It was every issue of Tim Seeley's Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Every issue. Okay.
There wouldn't have been a recap on the first issue, so I think two, three, and four.
Okay.
But to answer your question, yes. That is one of the big goals. When my schedule becomes less insane.
Yeah.
I have a book that's been approved, and it's been approved for over a year now, that I will be writing and drawing the entire thing.
Nice. Wow. Yeah.
So as I mentioned briefly earlier, I grew up with a stutter. And that's what it's about. It's a book about growing up with a speech impediment. And, you know, there's no kind of flights or tights or superpowers or anything like that. I wanted to make a book that I could give to a kid who was going through that, because that's a book I didn't have when I was a kid.
Sure.
And to that end, I can't imagine anybody drawing it but me. So who knows, man? I mean, we might be talking again in 10 years and there's still no progress on it, because somebody's got to write these Doctor Strange comics, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, excellent. Well, either way, I look forward to every project.
Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you for your time.
Of course.
Well, yeah. Okay, so we are going to wrap up. Can we call you again in the future?
Of course. Yeah, of course.
In like 5 minutes.
We're just going to have a little break.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. How do people find you if they want to find you?
Twitter, just find me on Twitter. It's at Don Cates, DonCates, because at Donnie Cates was taken. just find me on there. I'm on there too much, so I'm easy to find.
And can you tell? Can you tell us one spoiler? Is there something you know about Marvel that you can tell us?
I don't want to hear this.
Take your phones off. Okay. There.
Well, to answer your question,
no.
are there things that I know that you guys don't know? Oh yeah, all of them. And B, can I tell you? Fuck no.
That's the right answer.
We've talked a lot about it. I mean, the reason the four of us get together is we're a bunch of nerds and comic fans. And so, like, one of the reasons when we started the DoxCast, the very first episode of the DoxCast we ever did, three of us sat in a room with the New 52 solicitation book. And
wow,
we read here's a great podcast. We read all 52 solicitations and discussed them on a podcast. That
I wasn't
was a thing
a member
that
of
happened.
The podcast at the time. Yeah. I
wasn't even in the country.
Yeah. Wow.
Right. It was terrible. But you know,
you fucking nerd.
Yeah. So, you know, we just did our 200th episode. This is gonna be number 202 or 203. You know,
great.
The main purpose of the cast for the most part has just been to like talk about things around the shop, talk about things we like. The thing we've kind of figured out recently though is like we like love to like talk to people like you. You know, like we want to take things in a bigger direction, you know, like cuz and not for any reason. I think the reason you write comics from what I get a sense of is because you enjoy writing them, you know. And
oh,
so
yeah,
like that's what we've done for 200 episodes, but then we're like we're not pushing that boundary for ourselves. You know, we're not seeing what we can do, and that's what we want to do with this thing moving forward. And so we really appreciate you just, you know, the reason this happened, everybody, and I got it, Donnie Cates sent an email to, I assume, everybody on the Diamond email
list. Don't blow my spot up, dude. Don't tell him.
Oh, okay. All right, fine. I
no,
won't
I'm
do
kidding.
It.
No. No, I'll tell him. Yeah. I shamelessly emailed retailers asking them to vote for me to win an award, which I won, so thank you.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Yeah. Congratulations.
No, it was you were the only one of those I got, by the way, and it was awesome. And so, like, I just replied with, like, hey, I love your books. Like, I discovered God Country, like, afterwards and felt like an idiot that I should have known this book existed while it was coming out. I'm terrible at my job, you know. And then I was like, well, shameless plug, we got a podcast. Would you come on it? And he's like, yeah, sure. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Wasn't expecting
that. Easy,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah, so. Anyway.
I'm not a hard get.
Oh, not yet. We'll see. So we knew him when. So.
Yeah, right.
Well, yeah, no, thanks a lot. I don't know if anybody has a final word, but we need to go. And thank you very much for your time.
Of course. Of course.
We will talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Have a good day.
Bye.
This was a DoxCast. Hope you think it rocks cast. Oh, look at the clocks cast. Until next time, geek on.